Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I have as my guest John Lanchester. His new novel is called The Wall. Well, maybe I'm arrogant, but I think that the people who have been writing about this book, they say dystopian novel, they say George Orwell, they say 1984, Animal Farm. No. This is a book, The Wall, which takes the form of that kind of novel in order to tell a love story. And as the book progresses, the love story gets wilder and wilder. The people no longer have to just confront climate change. They're confronting pirates and secret islands and cargo cults, and, you know, it's a very wild and funny book. This book is a book that takes a lot of current crises and says, what is a novel? A novel is something that can possibly, if it wants to, have a happy ending. Now tell me, John Lanchester, why a happy ending?
I think it's partly a sort of Aristotelian thing that it's in the nature of stories to reach certain kinds of resolution, and actually the options are fairly limited for the kind of resolution you have. There's a flaw in the English novel, by which I don't mean the English language novel. I specifically mean the British English novel, and it's that they. Characters are left too pinned down and summed up, and it's like they have a moral end of term report card. And even very great writers, Jane Austen does it all the way through to E.M. Forster, who are, you know, giants. But I think it's a structural flaw with the English novel that you actually know exactly what you're supposed to think of them. They're sort of summed up ethically. Forster is particularly bad for doing that because he pretends not to. He pretends not to be judging, and it's saturated in judgment. And it was like a different sort of texture of story, a different texture of ending, where you don't have that thing that the characters end up, the moral equivalent of those butterflies or beetles pinned to a sample collection.
Well, you know, when I was a younger man, I was in graduate school, and they still in those days had a student read F.R. Leavis. His famous book was called The Great Tradition. And I'm sorry. I know that for the Leavises, F.R. Leavis and his wife Queenie, that The Great Tradition involved George Eliot, and it involved D.H. Lawrence. But the great tradition of the English novel also involves Lewis Carroll and Alice in Wonderland. It's the best language for fantasy. In fact, you have on the back jacket of this wonderful book, The Wall, one of the best writers in British fantasy today, Philip Pullman, recognizes it. He says, John Lanchester's previous novels have all been memorable evocations of the world we're familiar with, but The Wall is something new, almost an allegory, almost a dystopian future warning, partly an elegant study of the nature of storytelling itself. By the time you have gotten to the end of this novel, there are pirates and desert islands. It's full of not just the Conrad, this is what people are saying, the Conrad of the Heart of Darkness. No, it's it's also Robert Louis Stevenson of Treasure Island. It's a lot of what the British novel is famous for, boys' adventures. Now, if this is a modern novel, it's because there's a girl who's as important as the boy. What is her name?
Hifa.
Hifa, H-I-F-A?
Yeah.
And these characters, they begin as more or less sentries on a wall. They're watching to prevent the others from invading. Nowadays, if you have an enemy, his name or her name is the other. That's what we've taken to. It's the other. It's the thing we're afraid of. It's the not us. And by the time we're done, these characters have gone everywhere that an adventure book can take them. Did you have an awfully good time writing it?
It came very much in one go, in a way that no other book of mine has. It sort of emerged in a kind of dreamlike condition. And the points of reference you're talking about there are things that are really important to me. I think Leavis, you don't hear him talked about now much, but he was such a big deal.
Oh, he was the biggest deal.
And he made the English novel into this sort of moralistic, you know, he was always talking about things, you know, celebrating the value of life in this sort of preachy, afflatus-based way. And he very much distorted, I think, the strength of the English tradition, which, as you're saying, is, you know, the different traditions have different strengths. Nobody does the social novel better than the French. Nobody does the sort of novel of spiritual crisis better than the Russians. The English tradition just can't compete with that. And sometimes wishes it could, but it just flatly can't.
Well, you're absolutely right, because the great tradition poo-poos Dickens. George Eliot and Anthony Trollope referred to him disdainfully as Mr. Popular Sentiment. But they forgot how funny he is. And we've forgotten how funny he is because we don't read the Pickwick Papers anymore or Martin Chuzzlewit. We read Little Dorrit and Bleak House. These are the complicated Dickens novels, but they're not the hilarious Dickens novels. And the Dickens that people want to read is a bleak Dickens, but the Dickens I want to read is the Dickens celebrated by G.K. Chesterton, the hilarious Dickens. And I read, do you remember this? I read that a girl died laughing when reading the Pickwick Papers when it first came out. Now, surely my listeners have guessed this. I was a suicidal young man, and I was hoping that the Pickwick Papers would do its job. Instead, it made me laugh out loud, and I'm still alive.
I sometimes think of him almost more of a poet than a novelist, because he could squeeze his stories into novelistic forms, but he actually is in love with the fantastic in the form of his sentences. And his poetry is always introducing these elements of fantasy and the fantastic and then corralling them in this realistic setting. And that the people have forgotten that, you know, Dickens is in that English tradition of fantasy.
Well, people have forgotten that, but they've also forgotten that, you know, he's very modern. I forget which novel has Quilp in it. He's a hunchback, and he's terrifying. He's a wife-beater. He's not being praised. He's being damned for his lack of feeling. Quilp is the quintessence of unkindness. It's the old curiosity shop. Yes, you know why I read it?
Go on.
Oh, John Lanchester, I had been told that the Old Curiosity Shop was Dickens's worst novel, and that you had, Oscar Wilde said, to have a heart of stone not to laugh at the death of Little Nell. Well, when I read The Old Curiosity Shop, it was so crazy better than any other book I'd read in that 5 years. It was just, he's wonderful. And you see, what I think The Wall is a fantasy novel in the guise of a climate change end of the world novel.
It's great to hear you say this, because I think it's one of the secret things about the English tradition is this thing about fantasy and imagination and wildness.
Lewis
and the canon
Carroll,
is Carol.
Edward
and
Lear.
Exactly.
You know, British poetry.
That's the spine of English literature. Spenser, Chaucer, Milton, they are, and obviously Shakespeare, they're authors of the fantastic.
Yes.
In all certain senses. That's what English literature is. It's the fantastic.
I'm talking to John Lanchester about his novel The Wall. It's a novel that I think most of the reviewers have misunderstood. He's taken, yes, a book that we are busy writing nowadays, the end of the world novel, the apocalyptic novel, and said, if a novel is a place where the impossible, the unbearable, the inexcusable can happen, but the novelist is required by the nature of the novel to become wilder and wilder until a happy ending becomes part of the wildness. Well, that's what you've done, John. You've written the destructive novel with a happy ending. Did you mean it that way?
I meant the ending to be something of a Rorschach test. Because, you know, without giving away too many spoilers, the characters are fairly isolated. They're with each other. They're in a, you know, they're not in a kind of comfortable place in terms of how they'd see it themselves at the start of the book. And I've had a range of responses in terms of what the emotional texture of it is. But yes, I did want it to feel like relief, like a happy ending in the Aristotelian sense, like a sort of resolution for those characters, partly because the premise of the book, which is about catastrophic climate change, the premise is so unbearable and it offers no agency. I think that's one of the reasons it's such a difficult thing for us to get our heads around, so that you have to... they have to have agency somewhere. And so the agency comes out in the relationship, in their how they behave to each other, and in a sense in their adventures.
Ultimately, Aoife confides to her lover and her clearly life partner, however much life they have left, that's not clear. But her life partner, whose name is...
Joseph Kavanagh.
Yes. She says, I didn't really want to breed. Ultimately, her confession is that she wants to hear a story. He understands this, and he starts to tell her the very story we're reading. And the pleasure in the book is that he's turning it into a story. That is to say, life has no solutions. Life is hard. But a novel, a story, has solutions.
And making sense of what's happened to us through the stories. Stevenson's a writer I deeply love, and I think one of the magical things about Stevenson is he's their adventure stories. And he is also really, I think, close to being the ultimate writer's writer. I've never met a writer who doesn't revere Stevenson.
Stevenson is wonderful. He traveled all over the world. He spent time in Hawaii. And it's great we come to a treasure island in this book where everything you need for comfort can be found. And in this book, what are those things?
Well, each other is the main thing. I mean, that's the main thing I have. Other people and
light
and heat. Light, heat, food, safety.
Yes.
We're quite low down Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but, you know, we are there where the main things are located.
Yeah. And this is a very funny thing for John Lanchester to do, because he's written some very realistic books, nonfiction books, about the economy. How to Speak Money, for instance. And he's shown in his own autobiographical fiction, A Family Romance, that people are capable of nearly anything. Now this book, and here I'm not going to spoil anything, we're told by the narrator that the biggest liar he's ever met is one of the characters in this book. And in Your Family Romance, your mother is a supreme liar.
Well, she had one big lie, one big, you know, fiction, really, which is that she'd been a nun. She'd been a missionary nun in India for 15 years. And then she was Irish. She was the eldest of seven sisters. And when she left the convent and met my father, she took 10 years off her age, I think basically in order to marry my dad, by taking her sister's identity. And it was such an unlikely, and I only found out after she died, and it was such an unlikely thing, because she's a very, as you can imagine from someone who had literally been a mother superior of a convent school, she was a very, very, very moral person and anxious about breaking rules and proprieties and things like that. A very forceful person too. So it was incredibly surprising, the fact that, you know, the name on my birth certificate isn't actually my mother. You know, her legal identity wasn't actually the person she was. And I have always had an interest. I think all my books have an interest in people who can't quite... it's not so much that they actively lie, it's that they can't bear to tell the truth, which is not quite the same thing.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with John Lanchester. We've been waiting 25 years to finally get to talk. We met at lunch, but we never spoke on the show before, about his new novel, The Wall. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with John Lanchester about his new novel, The Wall. There's a narrator defending a wall surrounding the coastline of a dystopian island country, not unlike Britain. And as the book continues, this book, I would say, from the midway on, changes its nature. The characters turn out not to be who you thought they were. The situation turns out not to be what you thought it is. And I'd say that this is one of the real delights of novel writing. You've never taken it this far before, have you?
I've not in that way. My last book, Capital, was sort of large, multiple cast of characters, multiple perspectives. And I was actually working on another book that had something similar going on when this one sort of pressed itself on me. And I knew from a fairly early point that I wanted it to have that texture of, you know, we mentioned Robert Louis Stevenson. The thing I deeply admire about him is the complete translucency of the prose and of the surface, and these profound mysteries in the where the story goes. And you look like you're travelling in a straight line and then realise, like, wait a minute, no, you know, how did we end up here? John Williams is a writer who does that, and particularly in people, you know, that book Stoner has been brought back to to life. But Miller's Crossing, I think, is an extraordinary novel for, you think it's going to be one thing and it's one person's story and it's heading in a straight line, and it kind of bends and swerves and takes you around corners. And
yeah, I want to say that this is one of the pleasures of the novel, that somehow theory, literary theory, abandoned, left behind. Theory was so interested in proving that the language of the novel couldn't say what the language meant to say. Well, very good, this is possible. But there's no escaping that a great novel is in part a great plot, constantly bent by unexpectable, unanticipatable reversals and surprises. People don't think this way about the novel anymore, but that's what Anne Tyler is. That's what Anne Beattie is. That's what almost any enjoy. That's what Nabokov is. That great novels, shoddy novels, this is what they have in common. Surprise, reversal, and revelation about character that could not have been anticipated.
And it's a curious thing, given the immense body of theory and theoretical study of literature, I mean, which, has, you know, in some respects has taken over from actually reading books. It's curious that you have this huge body of theory that hardly ever talks about plot. If you want to have a conversation about plot or character, basically it's Aristotle or it's screenwriting manuals, which are about how to, you know, sell your screenplay for $1 million. And there's a colossal, you know, in the academy where people spend all day and all night thinking about theoretical structures for fiction, there's actually no discussion of it. It's really, really strange.
And it's been going on forever. And you see, people laugh at me because I have become a little bit too forceful in my dislike of theory. But theory is marvelous. If you were to read Foucault, if you were to read Roland Barthes, and even when you read Derrida on Plato, they're marvelous. But they're marvelous for intellectuals. Novels are for human beings. They're for people. I love to read. I love to read. There's a difference between loving to read and loving to think.
I agree. And I think, but one of the things about the novel is that it has an, unlike the other great artistic media, you can have an abstract sculpture, you can have an abstract painting, you can have an abstract piece of dance, you can have complete abstraction in almost every form, but you cannot have an abstract novel. The novel has this built-in connection with the reader. And it's why if we were having this conversation in 1960 and everyone was reading the Nouveau Roman and you know, fiction was in this deeply experimental moment, investigating its own procedures, and it was all about language. And as it were, Joyce had won, you know, that's what the novel was. And we might have concluded that, you know, that's what the novel was going to keep on being forever. But the novel took this turn, swerved back towards the reader. And the novel takes this swerve historically back towards story and character and all that, because that's what it is.
Well, it's not. I love Joyce.
Me too. And revere him.
And yes, revere him. And I love the crazy inspirers of the Nouveau Roman. Raymond Roussel is Mr. Plot. He's, no one can make up crazier, sillier events than Raymond Roussel or Georges Perec. They're completely, you see, I'd say that they're as daffy as Alice in Wonderland. And I'd say that the problem is that there were in the 60s all sorts of brilliant people, both teachers and students, and they wanted to make things thrillingly complicated, complex. Yes, by all means, we've got those. And T.S. Eliot had come and revised essentially the traditions of English poetry. Hugh Kenner, one of my teachers, likes to say that T.S. Eliot's plays are like Noel Coward and his poems are like Edward Lear. we've deprived ourselves of a beautiful thing when we deprived ourselves of the zaniness of the novel and its irrational capacities for happiness. And I want to praise my guest, John Lanchester, for having restored to the catastrophic novel the possibility. After all, it's a catastrophe that takes Dorothy to Oz, a cyclone, and then in the next book, an earthquake. Catastrophe gives way to wonder sometimes in the novel, not in life, but in the novel. And that's what makes a novel such a rich pleasure.
And it's one of the reasons we want to read them. And it's also if you're imagining a terribly altered reality and a world that we want not to happen, you know, I deeply hope that the world I'm imagining in this book doesn't come about. But you have to, if you're inviting the reader to imagine it, you have to give them something to get them through the book. You have to give them happiness, comfort, momentum, life, light, colour, in order to make the other thing bearable. The advocates of reading and reading fiction often make it sound virtuous and we should be doing it. And I often think it should be more like sex and drugs, you know, because sex has all sorts of proven health benefits, extensively documented, but literally no one in the entire history of the world has ever had sex for the health benefits. They do it for other reasons. And that's the same with reading, the same with fiction. You know, yes, it has proven health benefits. You know, almost nothing correlates with your life opportunities more than reading a lot, especially when you're young. But that's not the best reason to read. The best reason to read is just purely because it's fun, because of the pleasure.
I've been talking with John Lanchester, the author of The Wall. It's published by W.W. Norton & Company. Thank you, John, for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
This was great fun. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. Plus, you can listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer and assistant, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Tayari Jones is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.